Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. I just spoke with Agnieszka Hellman-Vajny about her new book, The Archaeology of Tibetan Books. This came out with Brill in 2014, and it is a book that you can get a lot out of if you are an expert in Tibetan studies, and you can get a lot out of if you know nothing about Tibetan studies. It's a book that is deeply and profoundly interdisciplinary in its approach to understanding books as material objects. And what Agnieszka does is she brings together interviews with Tibetan craftsmen and artists, her own experience as an artist and as a book and paper maker in terms of experimenting with techniques that she is studying, and also a history of and really close and careful and detailed work with book collections from various places across China, Tibet, and Central Asia, including libraries and collections in Europe, in North America, and beyond. So it's an amazing just depth of research that went into this study. What it does is gives us not only a history of bookmaking and papermaking techniques in Tibet, but also a really fine-grained material analysis of, I mean, everything from the pigments, the paper, and the paper-making techniques, what kinds of fibers are characteristic of what kinds of paper used in certain kinds of books from certain kinds of places, the kinds of materials that go into the ink. It's just an amazingly detailed appreciation of and study of books as materials and as objects. And if you read the book, as I had the chance to do just a little while ago, it really does change the way you see books, the way you observe and, you know, appreciate them, not just as objects, but also as text. So Agnieszka was really generous about making the time to talk with me about it. It was a lot of fun, and I hope you enjoy. Thank you for listening. I'm here today to talk with Agnieszka Hellman-Vajny about her new book, The Archaeology of Tibetan Books. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Agnieszka, and thanks so much for making time to talk with me today. I'm super excited about this. I think it's a book that is really important, not just for East Asian studies, but also for the history of the book and for the history of material objects. So welcome.
Welcome. Hello, Carla. Thank you very much for inviting me here. I'm really, it's a great pleasure to be with you.
So Agnieszka, can you start us off, as is traditional for the channel, by saying a little bit about what brought you to the field? And specifically, how did you come to work on Tibet and in Tibetan studies?
Mm-hmm. Oh, first of all, I should tell you that I'm not a Tibetologist really at all. I started as artist, so from the point of creation of the art, then I moved to the field of history and science. So I am a paper conservator, and then I had a PhD on conservation science, but it was quite early when I got interest in Tibetan cultural area and started to work on Tibetan paper making and Central Asia and Himalayas. So in fact, it was at the moment I chose the subject for my master thesis and diploma, which was a conservation of Tibetan book from Nepal. So that was a, I would say, starting point. And soon after, I realized when I start to search for information, so I would say, yeah, curiosity bring me here. So I met many interesting people, Tibetologists, scholars, Tibetans, and I realized that this part of knowledge discipline, my discipline, is really quite distant from Tibetology and also anthropological and historical studies. So I needed to build a bridge, so to get deeper into the field. At that point I started to do with my skills, so the conservation and material research on books. And I just started to search for interesting collections which could bring me more information on that subject, especially that I did not really this material side of books is rather very often neglected. So there are not many really reference literature and interest on the other side on this. So I think that's it.
That's great. Thank you so much. And that also speaks a little bit to how you came to produce this as a book length object as well. And the book itself really wonderfully treats books not just as repositories of text, but as material objects. And one of the terms that you use to talk about this kind of approach toward understanding and studying books in terms of their materiality and their objectness very early in the introduction is the term archaeology. So can you maybe kind of start by bringing us into the book by talking about this term archaeology? For you, what is the archaeology of the book, and what do we need to understand about how you're using that concept to understand the work that you're doing here?
Yeah, so in this field, I found many terminological challenges. I use the term archaeology, and I like to use this term which I understand as a description of physicality and historical context of the object. So it's very relevant to the term of codicology, I would say, in medieval, for example, books, European books. Since codicology comes from codex and Tibetan books are in the loose leaves format, so I found it better to use term archaeology. So it is why.
Great. Thank you so much. And so because the book really wonderfully takes us into the nature of the research that you did, the nature of the sources, and it's based on such a really fascinatingly interdisciplinary set of research methodologies. I'm going to be asking you a lot about that because I find it super fascinating. So let's dive in. So early in the book, you talk about the nature of the various source materials, so the collections of manuscripts and other books that you used as your kind of baseline set of documents for the book. So I'd like to ask you to talk about just a couple of them. So for anybody who works on China or Silk Road studies or anything kind of in the context of global exchange or the medieval world, the term Dunhuang is going to ring some bells, right? Dunhuang being a really important site for a lot of recent studies of the Silk Road and beyond. So one of the sets of books or sets of materials that you worked with are preserved Tibetan books from Dunhuang. So can you talk a little bit about those materials and the nature of that cache of Tibetan books as it influenced what you're doing here?
Sure, of course. Those are the, I would say, most important basic collection which I worked on. And I think that was the first collection of Tibetan books which was somehow noticed and described by other scholars as the physical objects. And of course, it's very important find, and it is in the British Library, but not only in Paris, in National Library, and also in St. Petersburg. So those are collections, but mostly Tibetan manuscripts are in the British Library, and that collection allowed me to write about, to touch somehow this earliest part of history of Tibetan books. Of course, then my general idea for the book was to select collections which could give us insight into different periods of time. So to have some kind of chronology. I haven't really achieved this yet because it's, but I hope just I was able to give to the readers some ideas about particular periods, not really chronology, because it's very problematic, in fact, to date Tibetan books. But this Dunhuang Tibetan manuscripts, for example, what was important during the work, I was collaborating closely with Dr. Sam van Schaik, curator of this Tibetan collection in the British Library. And we found out really many interesting objects, because this is the crucial part to select particular books for research. Mm-hmm. If you select them randomly, it's very difficult to interpret results. So we had to have some idea where they are from or who wrote them or about the context in general. And for example, with my paper research, I was able to identify paper in those earliest dated Tibetan manuscripts from Dunhuang, which was the mid of 9th century. So, and it was a paper made of Daphne plants, for example. So, you know, that is, this kind of information helps now to build the reference for the history of Tibetan books.
Thank you so much. And these details, the fact that the paper was made from Daphne plants, this is actually something that becomes really, really important for understanding the history of these books as material objects. And we'll definitely get to some of that later in much more detail, I think.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So you mentioned early in this chapter the importance of taking a statistical approach to Tibetan books, right? This sort of issue of representativeness or representation. And you also mention a couple of other major groupings of kinds of books that you worked with. And I'll just mention these because they'll come up later. Early printed editions of Tibetan conjures and illuminated manuscripts from Western and Central Tibet. And so we'll talk about those, I'm sure, in much more detail in a bit. You also mention the importance of specific collections of Tibetan books in terms of, you know, shaping the research here. And some of them are really fascinating. So I'd like to ask you to talk about one or two. You talk about the Ponder collection. Am I pronouncing that right? Ponder?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is Eugen Ponder's 865 books, originally in Berlin, now in Krakow. And that seems like a really, really important collection in terms of the work that you did here. So can you talk a little bit about that collection for listeners? What's so important about it for the work that you're doing here?
Yes, sure. That was one of the most important collections, I think, which I was able to work with as well, next to Dunhuang, of course. But that was collection which was deemed to be lost during the Second World War. And the interesting thing about that, it contained one of the first printed editions of Tibetan Kanjur. In fact, it is Wanli Kanjur, which is the reprint of Yongle Kanjur, which was printed in 1410, but this Wanli Kanjur was printed in 1606, but that was done from the same wooden blocks. And this is extraordinary collection since before we did not have originals, so we could not even be sure if it is really reprint or we just had mentions from before about it. And also history of this collection is very interesting because it was deemed to be lost during the war, and finally it was found. It was originally brought by Eugen Ponder to Berlin, to Ethnographic Museum. Then it was offered to the Staatsbibliothek. And then during the war, it was hidden. During the last stages of the war, during bombing, it was hidden in the Lower Silesia in Fürstenstein, Książ in Polish, castle. And then, after the war, the borders of the country were shifted, and Lower Silesia immediately became the part of Polish territory. So After some time in the 40s, this collection was found by Polish researchers and brought via Krzeszów, and finally it found its place in the Jagiellonian University Library in Kraków. But for many years, it was not loudly told. So it was kind of secret that this collection was not damaged. So nobody read, even in 2000, the great scholars, Dr. Eimer, wrote that this collection is probably damaged. So that, and really a few years, a couple of years later, I just during searching for Tibetan books in Poland for my PhD thesis, so I found this collection. So it was kind of, very exciting to work with this. And that needed to start from the beginning, because we needed first to confirm that it's really one Li Kanjur, what was expected. So I was working with two colleagues from the University of Warsaw, Professor Marek Mayer and Dr. Tukten Kunga Chasap. So we all were able to confirm that this is really one Li, and this is this important collection, so from 1606, and it is still there. And now I'm really happy that collection is entirely available for all scholars, and it's no more secret and no more situation like in the 70s or earlier.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And the introduction really takes us into stories about, it really becomes a kind of mystery tale, right? Tracking down, trying to track down the origins of some of the some of the books in the collections. You talk about checking out Pander's connection with, in particular, with the Yonghe Gong, right, an imperial monastery in Beijing.
Exactly.
And there's all these stories about other books. So there's a mysterious folio in the Library of Congress, which is like found by cleaners on the floor. This is just an amazing, just amazing set of stories for any bibliophile out there. So definitely listeners who are interested in this kind of story, set of stories about books, check out the introduction. Right?
I have to admit that this book brought me a bit into detective stories. I felt sometimes a bit like this. But that is also part of the histories of the collections, which is also important because, now there are so many subjects about, so many questions about ownerships of the collections, right? Mm-hmm. And those collections, especially Tibetan collections, really were brought from many countries, places, owners. And now it's sometimes it's very difficult to answer such a question, who should be owner now or something like this. So I hope also this kind of stories somehow contribute to better understanding of this kind of problems, I would say.
Absolutely. So the research for the book included, as we've been talking about, studies of the history of Tibetan books and the history of particular collections, but it also included other kinds of research that were not based on those kinds of sort of methodologies. So the book, as we've mentioned before, is very deeply interdisciplinary, and the research brought together what we might consider to be historical methods and scientific methods. It brought together interviews, experiments, microscopy, all kinds of really diverse modes of research to put together this story. So I'd love to ask you a little bit about that now.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the kind of research that we've talked about, you talk about the importance of interviews that you did with Tibetan craftsmen and artisans. So can you maybe talk a little bit about that for you? What was, what were some of the most important contributions that were made on the basis of your interviews with Tibetan artisans? And were there any moments in those interviews that were surprising for you, or that kind of dramatically changed or impacted how you were thinking about the topic?
Yes, of course. It's first, what surprised me the most, the same, how Tibetans can look at materiality of things, materiality of books in this case. So it was always very interesting for me to compare what I can read, what information I can derive from books by scientific analysis, for example, or by observation, by descriptions in the libraries, and confront this with interviews, which, of course, they usually refer to modern things, but tradition of bookmaking in Tibetan areas, it's still like has not changed much, I would say. So it's still relevant to go to compare this to the historical books, even from earlier centuries. But the interesting point in all this was, for example, when we were talking and I was asking about the paper, so they noticed totally different properties. For example, for them, it was just paper, Tibetan paper was poisonous because and very good quality and strong because of they know that it should be something special and not eaten by insects. From the scientific point of view, it is that this plant's properties are really a bit insect repellent, but not really poisonous word for word. Also, regarding materials, for example, like there are many myths in those information which are coming from interviews. Like somebody told me that Tibetan scriptures is the best, the highest quality, were written with stone pen. Of course, in reality, it was not possible. Probably it was wooden stick or bamboo pen, hard as a stone or something like this. So a lot of this kind of stories and differences in between interviews and material research, which I noticed, were really, I think, interesting.
Right. I think there's one moment in the book where you talk about a myth of the dark surface of paper being produced by with the use of ashes of llamas, right?
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's kind of an amazing set of stories, right? There's also some really interesting stories surrounding the use of blood, human blood as a pigment.
Yeah.
These books. Wow. So in addition to interviews with Tibetan artisans and craftsmen, you also conducted what seems to me to be, from the book and from the amazing images, right, and descriptions that you give us, quite a bit of experiments. And you describe part of the practice of research here in terms of experimental manuscriptology, personally reconstructing some of the techniques and copying fragments in some cases of books. So that seems to be really, really important here. Can you talk a little bit about that? What were some of the most important moments of or aspects of that research for you? And were there any special challenges in reconciling that kind of research with the other forms of research that you did for the book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is a very important part. For me, it was a kind of, this sphere was like a kind of exercises to check really how far the information I'm getting from, for example, interview can be true, right? And also what was very helpful, of course, I started as artist, so it was kind of natural for me. If I was not sure what could be used, I could check, right? So that's the same thing with types of paper, for example. When you write, depending on how the plant's properties influence the final results of, for example, calligraphy, right? So calligraphy, in fact, you know, everybody can talk about, for example, so paleographers or type of scripts or type of calligraphy, right? But it is very rare that somebody thinks really how materials influence this style. So by exercising this, by trying to write with the same pen, for example, on a different types of paper, helped me a lot to understand it. Or, you know, how Tibetans can change the properties of ink. In fact, we do not really have, it's very difficult to trace some products really to the beginning. So we have some general, also by scientific results. We can also, for example, identify the main materials. But all the tricks, I would say, which help to really keep this ink good and possible to use was just also by adding some other substances to have the ink more thick or more diluted or preserved better in the summertime or whatever. So this kind of things, I could make some experiment, I think, and that it would help a lot in many fields, in fact, just to add some practice to theory.
Great. Thank you so much. And there's an entire chapter, so chapter 2, that's devoted to exploring these methods and the importance of these methods for understanding the history and the sort of materiality of the books as you're giving them to us here. So in addition to talking about the importance of creating a kind of typology of Tibetan books, you talk in this chapter about the importance of the kinds of tools to, as you put it, read what's not written. So this includes understanding the preparation of book leaves, understanding inks and pigments, understanding the analysis of paper, and we'll get to that, I'm sure, in much more detail, and also understanding dating, right? Sort of how it is that we can go about creating a history that's based on even rough dating of the books. So because that last part seems really, really kind of challenging, right, and really important, can you talk a little bit about that? How did you go about dating these books, and what were some of the major challenges of that?
Yes, as I said before, it was, I think, the most challenging part. Mm-hmm. It was, of course, my general idea to find a collection for particular periods of time. But really, to date a book by materials, it's rather rare. It is possible. Because when you have a if we have references for the development of crafts, like papermaking or other materials production. But the problem with Asia in general, and especially in this Himalayan region, is that those things have not changed much, and definitely not enough to date books just on this basis. But if we overlap this knowledge with some typologies of formats, of page layout, all material types, which I would say materials are very important in the context of regional origin. It gives this space on chronology, on geography, I would say. And the best thing in what I found the most useful, it was just overlap as many information as possible, as many features as possible, and typologies of it. So this way only, I think, worked sometimes. So my research, I would say, are much more useful in the finding region of the origin, a bit less about dating. However, dating, it was possible in further perspective, mostly in collaboration also with other scholars who studied the texts and who could somehow add other hints. So if we see in the end that this points to the same ideas, so we could somehow also date in this way. But if the informations are scattered and not clear, so it's just better to wait for more sources.
Great. Thank you so much. And you just mentioned something that's actually really important for what's happening in the next part of the book, which is using a study of the materiality of these books and the paper and the pigments to try to get at something about the origins of the books. Where were they produced, right? Where were these made? And so you talk about the importance of materiality in those terms in several different ways. One of the most important ways, of course, is understanding the paper. So in identifying and studying paper, you talk here about several aspects of that material characteristic of books that are important, including the raw material that's used, the type of papermaking mold that's used, the way that leaves are prepared before writing or printing on them, which includes, you know, kind of sizing, which it affects the surface, flattening, polishing, sometimes with a conch shell, sometimes with stone, right? The color of the paper. And so you talk about the different aspects that, you know, we otherwise might very much take for granted when reading a book. Now, as we get to that, we get into the fourth chapter. So because it seems like one of the most important kinds of evidence that you're using here, that you're showing us for understanding where these books were made, has to do with the materiality of the paper, let's talk about that in terms of Tibetan books. So can you talk a little bit about really the raw materials of this paper? What are some of the most important materials used in Tibetan papermaking, and how does understanding those materials help us understand where these books were likely produced?
Sure. The most typical raw materials for making Tibetan books are, first of all, Timalasi family plants. So at the level and I can identify them are mainly two types of components. So one would be Daphne or Edgewortia, the bast phloem of the shrubs from this species. In fact, I cannot really clearly identify it in between Daphne and Edgewortia, so it is why I leave it as one type. But on the other side, we have very interesting raw material, which is Stellera hamajazme, which is Rechakpa in Tibetan, which is the bast of the root of the plant, which grows from above 3,400 or something like this in the Himalayas, up to 5,000 and sometimes even a bit more. So it definitely it differs comparing to the distribution of Daphne, which grows, or Edgewortia, which grows in the valleys, and definitely below 3,500 or 3,000 and lower. So that's the important thing to know this and to think about it at all, because it is clearly possible. It is possible to clearly differentiate in between Stellera and Daphne and Edgewortia. So we can know by knowing the paper production and all the technology. And also quality, which particular plants give. So, for example, Daphne is allows to make a better Daphne and Edgewortia, better quality papers than Stellera. And the difference is somehow Daphne has a bit more rigid fibers, a bit more stable, stronger. And Stellera, the fibers are a bit, we could say, through microscopy, it has some resemblance to cotton. So the properties of papers, not directly, but I would say in the way of properties of papers and later. So the Stellera are very soft fibers. So when you produce the larger sheet of paper, it's not stable enough in a large format. And also for manuscripts, sometimes its paper becomes too absorptive. And comparing to Daphne, Daphne has the natural sizing elements. So the fibers, in fact, are features that this paper does not really, Tibetans did not use any other glue for the singular sheet, for example. Of course, they then glued the leaves of the book of layers, so it is another technological development. But for example, Stellera with those properties is much better for printing, because it gives this softness and possibility to take inks when you touch the paper leaf to the wooden block.
Go on.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to ask you, since you just brought up, sorry for interrupting, since you just brought up manuscripts and also prints, right? And this is something that you actually talk about in this part of the book in chapter 4. For listeners who may not really be familiar with this aspect of what you're writing about, And because it's really, really important, more broadly speaking, in terms of book history and book studies right now, can you talk in the context of Tibet, or at least in the context of the materials you're working on, about how we should understand the relationship between these two forms, manuscript and print culture? Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that relationship between manuscript and print?
Yes, sure. Tibet is very exceptional on this side because it's just manuscript cultures and printing cultures are simultaneously has been developed since until now even. So in Europe, for example, we have, before Gutenberg, we have the manuscript cultures. And then when the printing culture started, almost manuscripts, became very rare and not really anymore useful in the same way. And in Tibet, both books, manuscripts and prints were simultaneously produced. It seems like they it developed this way for different purposes, for example. However, of course, we can ask questions and try to understand only why it developed this way. My personal view on this is that manuscripts, as they sometimes, they were produced as a special offering objects, very rich, very richly decorated with stones, attached to it with gold used for writing. So it was sometimes, they were offering objects or objects of rituals as well, and they were kept in the special libraries for special patrons and donors. So that's why probably they have been produced even in 20th century that way. And printing culture, of course, it helped to disseminate word of the Buddha quicker, as we know. But on the other hand, still, I feel like this printing projects in Tibet, they were so huge. So they involved hundreds of people sometimes, mm-hmm. particular craftsmen like the scribes, paper makers, printers, correctors, editors, donors, of course, sponsors of the project. So they were really large projects. In this context, we sometimes can have feeling that if somebody wanted to produce or gain spiritual merit just from preparing one copy of the book, maybe just simple manuscript without involving expensive materials and special technologies, it could be easier than to organize big printing project. So maybe that is reason why this simplistic, simple conditions in Tibet and, the needs, very specific needs of people created this situation that we have both printing and manuscripts cultures at the same time.
Thank you so much. I think that's really, really helpful. And also I'll mention for listeners that in chapter 4, you actually talk about the importance of patronage, right, for book production and take us into some of the material aspects of some of these very richly illuminated and decorated manuscripts, including painted borders and frontispieces, including the practice sometimes of painting the edges of a book in a particular color to ward off insects. So there's actually this really interesting sort of material significance to some of the colors that were used to sort of ward off being eaten by insects. And interestingly, and I think a really interesting contrast to some of the recent book studies from other areas of the world is you emphasize the rarity of doodles, right, of marginal drawings and doodle drawings. I think there's one doodle of a dragon on page 95 for listeners who are particularly interested in that. But otherwise, you note that perhaps because of these special conditions you've mentioned, there really are not many surviving doodles and manuscript, just kind of scribbles on these pages, right?
Yes, but you can find more within Dunhuang collection in the British Library, for example, but also on some, I noticed this on some Bone manuscripts in Columbia University Library. So they are rare, of course, but still it is possible to find those kind of illustration. Yeah, like a doodle.
Thank you. So the chapter four, before we move on, I'll also mention, has some really wonderful discussions of, you know, format and bookbinding style, of the importance of particular styles of calligraphy, of ink, different materials used as pigments, including blood, which is really interesting. And this is really important when taken together with the discussion of paper, in part because I think you're really helping us see these pages in a completely different way. I mean, in some of these discussions, you literally help us see the text and read it in a completely new way by pointing out, aspects of the shape of certain letters that you, based on your experience, right, and your craft and your research, were probably made with certain kinds of carving tools. And I mean, that's just amazing to sort of help us really to change the way we see. So I just wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you for telling about it. My reason as a researcher was somehow to try to say something more about origins and just the former things. But also, of course, I wanted to show to these books, because we had very basic information before in the written sources, or just, you know, the common view was just potty books and not much more. And they are really, there's a great variety in everything, in format and page layouts and decorations. So, and all those elements are important, and they are totally different from European book culture, of course, but also different from Chinese and from all others. So it's really many typically Tibetan elements in this.
What are some of the most important aspects of the differences between Tibetan and Chinese production in this way? I mean, you mentioned kinds of paper being really different, but can you talk a little bit about that for listeners who might be China specialists, who might be particularly interested in those distinctions?
Of course. So the formats, papers, I would start from this. For example, this potty format of Tibetan books, this loose leaf format, it's coming originally somehow from Indian culture, from the books on palm leaves called pustaka. So Tibetans tried to resemble, to keep the tradition from of making books from that side, and it is why we have those books form. However, of course, we did not have a palm leaf in Tibet, so they had to use paper. So paper probably came from ability to make a paper came from China, so, or from Central Asia. But it was no more limit of the format, because that was no reason to make such a narrow leaf like palm leaf. So because paper allows for a bit larger format, it is why we have different sizes of books, which are very specific and characteristic for Tibetan book culture. Also, this fact of gluing of book leaves of layers. And I would, immediately here we can point the difference in paper, in Chinese and Tibetan paper. For example, there are some Tibetan books on Chinese paper, quite many, especially those first edition of Tibetan Kanjus, which were produced in Beijing. So it also answers why on Chinese paper and Chinese materials. For example, Tibetan paper is much thicker and stronger, in fact. So Chinese paper was produced mostly, you know, Chinese were written with a brush at the first of all. So the paper had to be absorbent, paper had to be thin, the aesthetic was different. Paper, good qualities were just white as well. So, and Tibetan paper, because the production of paper was simpler, much simpler. So we have irregularities in thickness. So in fact, it was sometimes not nice and not stable enough to produce large format from just one layer. It is probably they glued the leaves of books off layers, of many layers. And also probably maybe they also wanted to make it similar somehow to palm leaves, mm-hmm. to make it thicker. But that is, you know, just hypothesis. But it would explain why they create a book in this way. Of course, we have the main difference comes from raw materials. Chinese use totally different raw materials, starting from rag paper, then paper mulberries and mulberries, then rami, hemps, right? So that this create different properties and different character of paper. So this and writing tools, I think, basically this makes this difference in between.
Thank you so much. That's really helpful, I think, and really interesting to think about this in a kind of comparative framework. Now, you alluded to several times already the importance of the conjure, right? We've talked about this. And you've talked a little bit about, in terms of the relationship between manuscript and print cultures, some of these major printing, like multi-year, just major printing endeavors that involved, you know, proofreaders, mm-hmm. scholars, wood collectors, and you talk us through the stages of production of some of these massive printing endeavors, from, you know, collecting the wood, carving the wood. There were doctors on staff, right? I mean, there were, mm-hmm. you know, greasing sure. the blocks with melted butter and the printing. So it's super fascinating and really, really an interesting part of the book. Now, can you, for listeners who are not as familiar with this notion of, you know, the conjure, or who may not understand why it would be so useful to look at editions of the Tibetan Buddhist canon for your purposes, can you talk a little bit about that? Why is, or why are editions of the Tibetan Buddhist canon so useful for studying what you're studying in here?
For me, they were really useful to look at them as a significance in the printing culture and also character to see regionality. Mm-hmm. So because they were produced, the Tibetan, particular editions of Tibetan culture were produced in different places. For example, in Beijing, like the first one, Yongle and Wanli. Then we have Chone or in the farther to the west. Then we have the Lhasa area, right, with the central Tibet Nartang Lhasa culture later. So we are moving geographically and also in time, and we can observe different developing of technologies. And the technologies in this case are also, and materials especially, are regional. And also this kind of study helps us in some cases to identify the workshops of printers, right, the printing projects. So by comparing, for example, all measurements in the page layouts, we can somehow group this. Why all of this? Of course, if we know exactly what we are analyzing, it's not the point. But there are many, many prints and Tibetan books which are still scattered around the world in Western museums, library collections, which are simply not identified. Mm-hmm. And especially in the 20th century, after, you know, Cultural Revolution, and many books were really somehow detached from their places. Mm-hmm. So there, it's very often we really need to know what we are dealing with. So my idea and my purpose was to build this kind of references. Because the text in particular edition is very difficult to really somehow classify the edition on the basis of text only. And I think for many years also Tibetologists has been working on the microforms. So they've never really seen even originals.
Right.
So that is the thing which I really, it was my main goal, main aim, somehow to show, to add this another layer of possibilities of research.
And that's actually really increasingly difficult to do, at least from the perspective of Chinese studies. More and more libraries and rare books collections and archival collections are not letting scholars use the original, like see the originals. In fact, you know, they're transferring things to microform, at least in China, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to do that kind of research.
Yes, exactly. And also that now we touch my another aim and goal. You know, looking from the point that the digital culture, right, is now really very rapidly developing. So we are going in this direction. So the physical books somehow stayed behind. And with my book, I wanted to show that it is really important and we may really add to our research if we still look at those books.
Did you have, I mean, in the course of your research, just, you know, since we're kind of on this topic, were there any cases in which there was a real challenge or a particularly notable challenge in getting access to some of these physical materials that you needed to in order to do this research?
I think I was, of course, some places are more difficult than others. I would not like, you know, to point to particular ones, right? But I would say I have been very lucky to meet right people all along my work, which were really curators and librarians, which were really very helpful and supportive for my work. However, of course, when I tried to access materials also during the field work, right, in China or in Himalayas, it is difficult. It's very accidental. Sometimes everything works and it's great, and sometimes it's simply impossible because, of course, libraries have own rules, and sometimes you cannot simply see or touch original, right?
That's right. So in the book, so as we kind of make our way through and come to the last part of the book, I'll just note for listeners that in Chapter 5, there's some really wonderful discussions of the production of and the kind of early editions and some later editions of some of these major printing endeavors, especially the Tibetan Buddhist canon. So there's some comparative and really, really interestingly detailed discussions of this kind of early edition of the Tibetan kanjur produced in Beijing, Mongolian kanjurs, and Tibetan kanjurs that are produced in Tibet and the Tibetan borderlands. So there's some really interesting stuff there for readers who are interested in that. And then there's also a whole chapter that I'm not going to ask you to talk too much about because we could easily spend another 2 hours on this chapter. But there's a very detailed, very, very rich chapter that surveys Tibetan paper, kind of everything you'd ever wanted to know, right, about Tibetan paper in Chapter 6, which goes into some of the really important microscopic analyses that we've been alluding to. It talks about the importance of Buddhist monks for spurring and spreading papermaking, kind of talks about the differences and the relationships between Tibetan and Chinese papermaking, and also talks about some of the really crucial tools and technologies of papermaking, including the kind of collection of raw material, the boiling, the beading, the molding. So it's a really fascinating chapter for all of those purposes. But this final chapter is really important and interesting as well, so I want to make sure we talk a little bit about that. And this is a chapter on conservation. Now, in this chapter, you talk about the particular challenges posed to the conservation of Tibetan books due to the significance of these books as sacred and ritual objects. So could you talk a little bit about that, sort of what for you is important for us to understand about these challenges of conservation, specifically with respect to Tibetan books?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a difficult chapter to write and to decide about the structure of it. But what was important for me, I wanted to show that since the approach to conservation and restoration in Europe and in Tibet is very much different. So just for those not familiar, I would say only that in European conservation, we mostly want to preserve historical substance and to add or just to not change it, to not add anything. But in Tibet, mostly people understand the conservation as replacement with new thing, the old thing with new thing, because it has to be useful. Of course, the books are sacred, so they are not thrown out. They are often buried in the stupas, or they are burned sometimes. But it means totally different thing than in Europe. So even starting from this point, we have to think how to preserve those objects and to in my opinion, we should really think also about Tibetan people. It's not only that we want to do in our way, right? So it's necessary to somehow find a way which will be the most useful to preserve cultures as well. So I tried to somehow describe only a couple of practical methods, the places where the books are, the preservations and storage problems. So I wanted to show in this chapter mostly the problems we have, right? And I did not try to give, detailed answer to everything. Yeah, but I just wanted to make a reader more familiar with the subject. And also in the context that many books were really damaged in the 20th century. And as I mentioned before, many are detached from their original places. And we have Tibetan books almost now all around the world in museum and library collections. And those objects really need special care. We cannot conserve them as we usually do with European books or with other books from other cultures. So they are specific because of the materials, because of the technologies. So we need to consider exactly materials and how those books were made originally, to understand the process of deterioration, to decide also about the methods. So that was my goal, I guess.
Thank you so much. And this is this chapter is useful, not just because it runs through and describes, many of the typical ways that Tibetan books get damaged, sort of sources of that damage, and some selected procedures, as you give us here in the book, for conservation of these materials, but also really, I think, helps us think anew about what conservation means, right? And you make the point, I think, very effectively early in this chapter, that what it means to preserve an object for one group of people may look like destroying it to another. And that's actually really, really important, I think, for how we think about what conservation means conceptually and how to sort of work across and with all of these different communities in the way that might be most productive. So, So now that we're at the end of the book, I'll just mention for listeners, there are also a series of really useful appendices that describe in detail some of the items from some of the major collections you're working on, some of the features of the paper in a lot of those items. There's an appendix that's just devoted to transcription of Yongle covers. And there's also just a lot of, that is to say, material in just the appendices that we are not talking about in detail. That's just really rich archival fabric for many, many other studies. So the book is not just a report on your research, but it also offers a lot of material to enable the research of others, hopefully many years into the future. So Agnieszka, we've talked about a lot of the book, but of course there's a million billion things we didn't talk about. Is there anything in particular that we haven't talked about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book?
Yeah, I think the main thing I would like to mention here maybe just to summarize that at the present point where with the all development of digital culture, digital world, digital books, so I wanted really bring attention of people to those original objects, and also to write this book not only for scholars of Tibetology or paper conservation, but also for those who are not as familiar with the subject, just to show how beautiful objects they are, those Tibetan books, and to somehow encourage people to look at this. So I guess that's it. I cannot think now what I...
and that's actually really helpful, because it also reminds me to mention something that I really love about the book, which is the images and the illustrations. There's just tons mm-hmm. and tons of beautiful color images of the paper, the fibers you're talking about, but also the pages, the ways that these books are shaped. So it's a really beautiful archive of images of Tibetan books and paper as well. So Agnieszka, now that the book is out, and congratulations on the book, what's next
Thank
for you?
You?
What are you working on now?
Oh, I would mention two things. I'm completing now another book from my very recent project on the paper roads, A Case for Central Asian Origins. It is basically about the history of paper in Central Asia, those earliest part, and I just try to put some more hypotheses into origins. So that is one thing. And the other thing is I'm starting also now project on material analysis of archival documents from Nepal Mustang. So that is another thing I'm going to work for next couple of years.
Well, best of luck with that work. We'll look forward
Thank
to those
you.
Coming out as well. And thanks again. It really was a pleasure. And thanks very much for making the time.
Thank you very much to you, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.